This is Going Underground, and I'm Afshin Ratansi, recovering from a sinus operation, so bear with me. Shout out to Dr. Jans here in Dubai. We broadcast all around the world from the UAE, whose President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan met with Russia's Vladimir Putin in Moscow this week. That's ahead of perhaps Trump-Putin talks in the UAE. All this amidst the UK-US-EU-Israeli genocide in Gaza and a new Iranian nuclear weapons strategic ambiguity in this region. Today is 80 years since the USA at 11.02 a.m. local time killed up to 70,000 civilians in Nagasaki in Japan. That nuclear bomb followed the Hiroshima atrocity, even though it's widely accepted Japan was already preparing to surrender to the USSR. The USA is still the only country that has ever used nuclear weapons against civilians. Today's Nagasaki anniversary may serve as a stark reminder to Russia, Iran, Palestine, China, Brazil, any country willing to stand up to it, of the savagery of the United States. Joining me again from Cleveland, Ohio, is veteran congressman and former mayor of Cleveland, Dennis Kucinich, who has fought for global peace all his life. He's run twice as a U.S. Democratic presidential candidate and most recently ran as an independent candidate for Congress in the 2024 U.S. election. Dennis, thanks so much for coming back on. I was going to start being very grim because this week there were Ohio-class submarines apparently being redeployed against Russia, nuclear weapons coming to my birthplace of Cambridge in RAF Lakenheath, all courtesy of Donald Trump. And now, perhaps by the time this broadcast, it could be cancelled, but and now perhaps a meeting between the two nuclear weapons superpowers. What to make of it? Trump and Putin.
First of all, Afshin, it's good to be with you again, and speedy recovery. It doesn't behoove any nation with nuclear weapons to be whistling while they walk through the graveyard of a nuclear nightmare past. We have an obligation to get rid of nuclear weapons. I spoke to the United Nations several years ago on this point. And, you know, we have to get rid of those weapons before the weapons help get rid of us. Now, it is critical that President Trump and President Putin are talking about how to avoid an escalating conflict between the United States and Russia. It doesn't serve either country to have this conflict, but, you know, from the United States standpoint, it has to be understood, and I think Russia does understand it, that President Trump is under enormous pressure domestically, and the signaling that goes on that would in many cases be escalatory might in fact be more likely a response to events that are going on domestically. The Epstein scandal is one. The public's, the president's political base response to the genocide in Israel. The Senate's decision to keep adding money to help support Ukraine against Russia. These are first domestic problems that, of course, end up having international implications. And I believe Russia is aware of that. And just as America must be aware that Russia is not going to be intimidated by NATO or the EU, and that Russia is not going to go back to the days of the Orange Revolution, which were used to attempt to encircle Russia as a prelude to an attack. So we're in an important strategic moment here. And it's not just that cooler heads must prevail, but that we need to understand there's a whole new strategic architecture that's been created in the world since the 80 years ago. And it's time that we proceeded with not just an understanding of it, of that architecture, but that we proceeded in a manner which is consistent with the understanding that this is no longer a unipolar world.
Yeah, you were briefly chief of staff to a presidential contender who is now in the Trump cabinet. So it's interesting talking about the power dynamics that you imply there. The Times of Israel had a piece this week saying, as regards the Epstein files, files are threatening him. It's actually a piece saying Trump is not enough of a slave to Israeli policy as he should be. Perhaps Trump will realize it really doesn't pay to start up with Israel, complaining that Trump didn't continue the war on Iran. So what are the forces there? And do you think Trump overcame a lot of opposition in the so-called deep state to arrange a meeting with Putin? The Russians say it was the Americans wanting the meeting.
Well, there's a couple different ways to look at this. One is that there are elements of the deep state that are honeycombed into the Trump administration, and that they are having their impact on policy. That they did have an impact.
You think Gaza particularly?
You could say Gaza, but also it's global. It's Gaza. It's Iran. It's Russia. I think that we have to keep in mind that with respect to Gaza, the United States policy, not just Trump, but the United States policy has been consistent over the last few years with Biden and now under the Trump administration supporting the genocide in Gaza. And I mean, if there was any respect for international law, we would understand that every official who was involved in that would be subject to being hauled before the International Court of Justice. But we know right now this isn't the moment when international law is well regarded. However, as has been pointed out in a recent article, the fact that national courts can seek enforcement of violation of international laws. So I think President Trump is certainly, you know, certainly has had enormous support for Israel, and that reciprocal relationship has been more one-sided. Netanyahu has benefited greatly from it, and Netanyahu is just trying to stay out of jail, while at the same time he lets the right wing, led by Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, move forward with their ethnic cleansing, genocidal fury that is about a greater Israel, which at this point is probably one of the a peerless oxymoron. So we really are in a moment where it is important for the President of the United States to take hold and to really use the power of the office for peace. It was said that President Trump was intending to do that in this term, but he hasn't fulfilled that promise. The attack on Iran was a warning, not just to Iran, and not a warning in terms of limiting Iran's retaliatory capacity, of course, but it's a warning of how a president, even with what might appear to be good intentions, can be pushed into a position of going against what he committed to his political base. That is, you know, he committed peace. We wouldn't be going into those old wars again. He would solve the Ukraine-Russia conflict in a day. Well, that's not happening. And Russia, as I said, must be aware of the pressures that President Trump is under. And as a Russian official recently remarked, it's a time for calm and for looking for ways to climb down the escalatory ladder. And of course, Witkoff's visit is, I think, part of that, and a meeting between, a personal face-to-face meeting between President Trump and President Putin. Would be helpful in moving the world in a towards a position of more global security.
If the Russian government has to understand that, how long do you think the Russian people are going to keep going with Putin's policy of restraint after years of U.S. weaponry attacking their cities and NATO weaponry attacking their cities, and seemingly no Putin reaction against the source of all these weapons.
You know, I would not presume to give President Putin any advice at all. I think his approach has been measured. He has avoided escalation. He understands that escalation can quickly lead to that dialectic of conflict, which can be deadly for Russia and the United States. Now, Afshin, I want to make this clear. I've been to Russia about a dozen times, and I've been to Ukraine many times as well. But what I learned from being in Russia, and most Americans don't understand this, the Russian people lost almost 30 million during World War II. When you go out of the city and past those giant girders that are covering the highway on, going from Sherman-Tavo Airport, they mark the spot where the German army was stopped. Russia has suffered greatly in war. President Putin understands that. He doesn't want that to happen again. He wants to see the Russian people, I'm sure, gain the benefits of a stronger economy. And you can't do that if you're in forever war. And the war in Ukraine has been costly for Russia. It's been costly for the United States, not in the same way. But I think leaders of all nations should want to take care of their own people first. And you can't do that by committing yourself to war. And we have to keep in mind, there are elements in the world who profit from war, who want to keep things stirred up, who want to pit nations against each other for their own narrow benefits. We're in a whole new era now, which is escalating fast into a nuclear war would destroy everyone. There's just no logic anymore to nuclear war. That's why we have to get rid of all nuclear weapons. I mean, I am for nuclear abolition. I think that every nation should determine that it's in their best interest to get rid of nuclear weapons and to seek out any place in the world where the elements exist to create nuclear weapons. So, you know, we're in a perilous moment in world history, that not unlike the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it's a little bit more glib, because we have to recognize that this particular crisis that began with the United States, with our president sending nuclear bombers to Suffolk in England and unleashing nuclear armed submarines towards towards Russian waters, that this is, in my estimation, this is about domestic politics more than it is sensing that Russia is a threat.
Dennis Kucinich, I'll stop you there. More from the twice U.S. Democrat presidential contender and former mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the twice U.S. Democrat presidential contender and former mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, Dennis Kucinich. Dennis, in part one, you were talking about, how close the nuclear clock is to midnight, essentially. In congressional hearings, you've questioned military and executive branch chains of authority. What did you think when, I don't know whether you heard it, the commander of U.S. forces, the commanding general of U.S. forces, General Donahue, appeared to say that they're preparing to invade Kaliningrad, a Russian territory between Lithuania and Poland, and they're ready to do it. And they're all up for this. Presumably it would have to be cleared through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane and Pete Hegseth. This was before the sudden announcement of a perhaps meeting between Trump and Putin, perhaps in the UAE.
I mean, that's lunacy. It's some kind of a pipe dream that ideologues have. And when you work from ideology, particularly Cold War ideology, and you're enmeshed in that, it's not a pair of glasses that you put on to see the world. It's a blindfold. You can't see. You're groping. And this kind of talk.
But that's much worse than 1962. Sure, yeah. No one in 1962.
Oh, it is.
That was about stationing weapons in Turkey and Cuba. This is about the United States invading Russia.
Yeah, I mean, really, first of all, I believe NATO ought to be disestablished. I've said that before. This isn't like a new statement. Instead of building up their arms, the European Union ought to use its increased willingness to go to 5% of their GDP for weaponry instead to improve the lives of the people in the in their respective countries, so that they can be assured healthcare, education, decent income, good retirement that people aspire to. Now, if I had been in a position to do anything about it, I would have encouraged that particular general to take a long vacation.
Well, unless it was cleared from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and presumably by the president, you can't have the what's his official role, commanding U.S. general of U.S. forces in Europe. He would have had to clear that, I think.
Well, a lot of these guys just mouth off and then all of a sudden they get tapped on the shoulder. I don't know, and the thing we have to be careful of, I just want to go back to staying calm. But at the same time, don't overlook this. I wouldn't overlook it. I mean, if I was looking at it from the Russian side, I would go, what? Look, in September, last September, President Biden was firing missiles towards Russia that augured a nuclear war. He left. Now, with people in the Trump administration, notably General Kellogg, whose whole approach is escalate, because he says, well, President Putin's bluffing. Well, bluffing about what? Russia doesn't seem to be in a position where they're trying to take over the world. Each country has the right to defend itself. And I think that we in America need to demand that high-ranking military officials and civilian officials restrain their rhetoric, because words follow thought and deeds follow words. And we need to start to come up with a new strategic approach, which isn't about war, but is actually about the science of human relations, also called diplomacy. And diplomacy isn't just a meeting. Diplomacy is an arc, a continuum of reciprocal relations that help to build trust. And we're not there. We need to get there. We need to understand that that weapons are not going to solve whatever plagues the human condition right now. And throughout history, there's been opportunities for nations to come to terms with each other. But as Barbara Tuchman wrote in her masterpiece, The March of Folly, worse often was chosen as a better reason. And that a wooden head thinking resulted in disaster for countries throughout history. And at this point, we have an obligation in America to demand that our leaders exercise restraint and stop this chest thumping, which is ego driven and sometimes megalomaniacal to the point of endangering the world.
Except of course, your party, the Democrats, or it was your party. There was no diplomacy. There was no diplomacy at all.
It's my, It's my party and I'll cry if I want to. You've heard that song.
Yeah, precisely. Well, there was no diplomacy at all. There were just force, just weapons under genocide Joe Biden and Holocaust Harris. This is something different, thanks to Donald Trump, because he is speaking. And there has been diplomacy, and he says he rings Putin all the time, but presumably he has this idea that he can have diplomacy with force, unlike Biden and Harris, who just said bizarrely, unprecedentedly, presumably, no talking at all.
Well, first of all, President Putin and President Trump have had many discussions, and they need to keep talking. But at no time in any relationship that one wishes to endure, does either of the parties put a gun on the table, as America did recently. It's totally counterproductive, even if it's some kind of a tactical move for domestic consumption. I think, you know, President Putin's restraint and his patience have been important, not just to Russia, but to the world. You know, certainly we want to see the Ukraine conflict brought to an end. But it's not going to be brought to an end simply through a ceasefire. Let's not kid ourselves about that. Ceasefires are often used for one of the sides to rearm and get ready to reengage. There needs to be some definitions and demarcations considered and confirmed so that this doesn't happen again. And Ukraine has suffered mightily. I mean, I represented a constituency in the Cleveland area, which included Ukrainians, Russians, people from throughout Eastern and Western Europe. And we don't need to get pulled into a wider war here. And I think that President Putin has been very measured, even lawyerly in his approach. And on the other hand, as has been pointed out, if there was, horror of all horrors, a first strike from the United States, Russia does have what's called the dead hand, a retaliatory capacity, and the missile accuracy to be able to bring events to a conclusion. We don't want to go there, though. And, you know, you know, people need to talk to each other. This whole idea about a nuclear sort of Damocles hanging over the world ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki 80 years ago, we have to lift it. We have to engage each other from soulfully, not just with this egocentric approach, which tries to measure each other in terms of some psychology of strength. You know, we have to begin to see each other as human beings and as potential friends, not as enemies. And that's the way the world can survive. We can do that. Party politics, it's not the path to that.
Except the past past experience shows with his attempt to get a lasting peace in the Koreas, that usually is a gun on the table. He gets the talking started, which is amazing, and it's a great advance, and it's great progress, and then he puts a gun on the table, exactly your phrase, at which point there is no progress. I mean, do you fear that's...
Well, we can't do that, is what I'm saying. That has to stop. That's not productive. That's not going to move towards a resolution of any of the issues that are out there between the United States and Russia, which are geopolitical, economic, military. There's a whole range of issues that the United States and Russia need to discuss, but it can't always be under threat of war.
Clear, just finally. Finally, Dennis.
Although I have to say, we are in war. You know, the Ukrainian attack on and Ukraine enmeshed in this conflict with Russia, that started at the instance of the United States. And that has to be pulled back. I think President Trump tried to do that, but there's pressures to keep it going.
And many of his cabinet are aware of it. But clear also, finally, that the American people, polls showing their distaste for Israel, majorities against Israel in the United States, I think majorities changing on the proxy war in Russia through Ukraine. Clearly, the American people have more on their minds, as in everyday inequality, social mobility, and catastrophic living conditions in the United States. Life expectancy in Mississippi, 71.9. That's, doesn't really compare with Iran at 81, Venezuela at 76.5.
Well, let's, as we start to conclude this discussion, I just want to say that that the public opinion in the United States should be shifting against what Israel is doing in Gaza, that it is genocide, and that every Israeli official who's involved in it must be held to an account. But it has to stop, we have to stop fueling it. We have to stop sending, the U.S. must stop sending any money at all to Israel. And we have to use our influence, if we have any influence, with Israel, to stop the genocide and to come up with a way to secure the future for all Palestinians, Gaza or the West Bank. A looming problem is this settlers. I don't know why you call them settlers, because actually, if somebody goes into somebody's house with a gun and just steals their home, that's called a thief. It's not called a settler. And we really need the United States to change our relationship with Israel. And this is the people in the United States are ready for that. When they see these settlers getting health care and support for housing, what? There's people in the United States that can't afford their rent. They're having trouble making ends meet. Their mortgage payments are ballooning. People can't send their kids to college that they were hoping to. Young people can't get jobs.
Dennis Kucinich, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our condolences to those still suffering from the aftermath of the U.S. nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and to those suffering NATO-armed bombing of Gaza, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, and Iraq. We'll be back on Monday with the former special advisor to UN Secretaries General Kofi Annan, Ban Ki-moon, and Antonio Guterres, Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Until then, keep in touch, follow all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and help to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com. See you Monday.